Chapter 48. Never been more than a little impalpable barrier between them, and yet he had suffered it to keep them apart. And now, though it seemed slighter and frailer than ever, it had suddenly hardened to adamant, and he might beat his life out against it in vain. He had dropped on his knees beside the bed, but a touch from Jerdy aroused him. He stood up, and as their eyes met he was struck by the extraordinary light in his cousin's face. You understand what the doctor has gone for? He has promised that there shall be no trouble, but of course the formalities must be gone through. And I asked him to give us time to look through her things first. He nodded, and she glanced about the small bare room. It won't take long, she concluded. No, it won't take long, he agreed. She held his hand in hers a moment longer, and then, with a last look at the bed, moved silently toward the door. On the threshold she paused to add, "Colin, you will find me downstairs, if you want me." Selden roused himself to detain her. But why are you going? She would have wished. Jerdy shook her head with a smile. And no. This is what she would have wished, and as she spoke a light broke through Selden's stony misery, and he saw deep into the hidden things of love. The door closed on Jerdy, and he stood alone with the motionless sleeper on the bed. His impulse was to return to her side, to fall on his knees, and rest his throbbing head against the peaceful cheek on the pillow. They had never been at peace together, they two. And now he felt himself drawn downward into the strange mysterious depths of her tranquility. But he remembered Jerdy's warning words. He knew that, though time had ceased in this room, its feet were hastening relentlessly toward the door. Jerdy had given him this supreme half hour, and he must use it as she willed. He turned and looked about him, sternly compelling himself to regain his consciousness of outward things. There was very little furniture in the room. The shabby chest of drawers was spread with a lace cover, and set out with a few gold-topped boxes and bottles, a rose-colored pincushion, a glass tray strewn with tortoise-shell hairpins. He shrank from the poignant intimacy of these trifles, and from the blank surface of the toilet mirror above them. These were the only traces of luxury, of that clinging to the minute observance of personal seemliness, which showed what her other renunciations must have cost. There was no other token of her personality about the room, unless it showed itself in the scrupulous neatness of the scant articles of furniture. A washing stand, two chairs, a small writing desk, and the little table near the bed. On this table stood the empty bottle and glass, and from these also he averted his eyes. The desk was closed, but on its slanting lid lay two letters which he took up. One bore the address of a bank, and as it was stamped and sealed, Selden, after a moment's hesitation, laid it aside. On the other letter he read Gus Treanor's name, and the flap of the envelope was still ungummed. Temptation leapt on him like the stab of a knife. He staggered under it, steadying himself against the desk. Why had she been writing to Treanor writing, presumably, just after their parting of the previous evening? The thought unhallowed the memory of that last hour, made a mock of the word he had come to speak, and defiled even the reconciling silence upon which it fell. He felt himself flung back on all the ugly uncertainties from which he thought he had cast loose forever. After all, what did he know of her life? Only as much as he had chosen to show him, and measured by the world's estimate, how little that was. By what right the letter in his hand seemed to ask, by what right was it he who now passed into her confidence through the gate which death had left unbarred? His heart cried out that it was by right of their last hour together, the hour when she herself had placed P-341 greater than the key in his hand. Yes, but what, if the letter to Treanor had been written afterward? He put it from him with sudden loathing, and setting his lips, addressed himself resolutely to what remained of his task. After all, that task would be easier to perform, now that his personal stake in it was annulled. He raised the lid of the desk, and saw within it a checkbook, and a few packets of bills and letters, arranged with the orderly precision which characterized all her personal habits. He looked through the letters first, because it was the most difficult part of the work. They proved to be few and unimportant, but among them he found, with a strange commotion of the heart, the note he had written her the day after the bride's entertainment. "When may I come to you?" His words overwhelmed him with a realization of the cowardice which had driven him from her at the very moment of attainment. Yes, he had always feared his fate, and he was too honest to disown his cowardice now. For had not all his old doubts started to life again at the mere sight of Trina's name? He laid the note in his card case, folding it away carefully, as something made precious by the fact that as he had held it so. Then, growing once more aware of the lapse of time, he continued his examination of the papers. To his surprise, he found that all the bills were receipted. There was not an unpaid account among them. He opened the checkbook, and saw that, the very night before, a check of $10,000 from Mrs. Peniston's executors had been entered in it. The legacy, then, had been paid sooner than Gertie had led him to expect. But, turning another page or two, he discovered with astonishment that, in spite of this recent accession of funds, the balance had already declined to a few dollars. A rapid glance at the stubs of the last checks, all of which bore the date of the previous day, showed that between $400 or $500 of the legacy had been spent in the settlement of bills, while the remaining thousands were comprehended in one check, made out, at the same time, to Charles Augustus Treanor. Selden laid the book aside, and sank into the chair beside the desk. He leaned his elbows on it, and hid his face in his hands. The bitter waters of life surged high about him, their sterile taste was on his lips. Did the check to Treanor explain the mystery or deepen it? At first his mind refused to act. He felt only the taint of such a transaction between a man like Treanor and a girl like Lily Bart. Then, gradually, his troubled vision cleared, old hints and rumors came back to him, and out of the very insinuations he had feared to probe, he constructed an explanation of the mystery. It was true, then, that as he had taken money from Treanor, but true also, as the contents of the little desk declared, that the obligation had been intolerable to her, and that at the first opportunity as he had freed herself from it, though the act left her face, to face with bare unmitigated poverty. That was all he knew, all he could hope to unravel of the story. The mute lips on the pillow refused him more than this, unless indeed they had told him the rest in the kiss they had left upon his forehead. Yes, he could now read into that farewell all that his heart craved to find there. He could even draw from it courage not to accuse himself for having failed to reach the height of his opportunity. He saw that all the conditions of life had conspired to keep them apart, since his very detachment from the external influences which swayed her had increased his spiritual fastidiousness, and made it more difficult for him to live and love uncritically. But at least he had loved her, had been willing to stake his future on his faith in her, and if the moment had been fated to pass from them before they could seize it, he saw now that, for both, it had been saved whole out of the ruin of their lives. It was this moment of love, this fleeting victory over themselves, which had kept them from atrophy and extinction, which, in her, had reached out to him in every struggle against the influence of her surroundings, and in him, had kept alive the faith that now drew him penitent and reconciled to her side. He knelt by the bed and bent over her, draining their last moment to its lees, and in the silence there passed between them the word which made all clear. The end. Notes. 1. I have modernized this text by modernizing the contractions. Do an apostrophe T becomes don't, etc. 2. I have retained the British spelling of words like favor and color. 3. I found and corrected one instance of the name Erdy, which I changed to Erdy to be consistent with the rest of the book. Linda Ruoff. End of Project Gutenberg's A Text of House of Mirth by Edith Wharton. Mirth by Gutenberg Edition.